of Jesus with our teaching series, and we're up to Matthew chapter 13, which is the kingdom parables. And up to this point, Jesus has been speaking quite openly in the public. We had the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes and that sort of thing, where he spoke very plainly to people. But from this point in his ministry onwards, he only speaks in public in parables. There's a huge change, because chapter 12, he was rejected as being the Messiah. The miracles that he was doing to demonstrate that he was the Messiah were put by the religious leaders. They attributed those to being the power of Satan. And so that rejection has then led to this point onwards, he's speaking only in parables. Why do you think he would speak in parables? You know, normally we'd think that a parable is a story to help explain something and make it easier for people to explain. But thankfully, we don't have to guess at why he spoke in parables, because the disciples themselves asked Jesus, "Why are you speaking only in parables?" Let's have a look at what Matthew recorded as Jesus' answer. It says, "Then the disciples came to him and asked Jesus, 'Why do you speak to the people in parables?' And he answered them, 'You have been given knowledge about the secrets of the kingdom from heaven, but it hasn't been given to them. Because anyone who has something, more will be given, and he will have more than enough. But for the one who doesn't have anything, even what he has will be taken away. That is why I speak to them in parables, because they look but don't see, they listen but don't hear or understand. With them, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, you will listen and never understand. You will look and look, but never comprehend. For the people's heart has become dull, and their ears are hard of hearing. For they have shut their eyes so that they might not see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and turn, and I would heal them. How blessed are your eyes because you see, and your ears because they hear. I tell all of you with certainty, many prophets and righteous people longed to see the things that you see but did not see them, and to hear the things that you hear and did not hear them." And then a little later in the chapter, Matthew records or makes this comment, "Jesus told the crowds all these things in parables. He did not tell them anything without using a parable. This was to fulfill what was declared by the prophet when he said, 'I will open my mouth to speak in parables, and I will declare what has been hidden since the creation of the world.'" So being hidden since the creation of the world means that the information that Jesus is presenting in these parables is something that's not found plainly in the Old Testament. The Apostle Paul was also given this privilege of being able to present information that had been hidden from the people of the Old Testament times. And in Ephesians 3, Paul writes, "This secret was made known to me through a revelation, just as I wrote about briefly in the past. By reading this, you will be able to grasp my understanding of the secrets about the Messiah, which in previous generations had not been made known to human beings, and has now been revealed by God's Holy Spirit to the apostles and prophets." This is that secret. The Gentiles are heirs in common, members in common of the body, and common participants in what was promised by the Messiah Jesus through the gospel. So the church is that secret that was hidden in the Old Testament times. This whole church age that we're in now wasn't plainly revealed in the Old Testament, but has been revealed in the New Testament. So the kingdom parables then are Jesus revealing aspects of this church age. In the Old Testament times, when someone wanted to come and worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they would have to do what Ruth did. You remember the story of Ruth? She was a Moabitess, and she gave up her family, her culture, her religion. She gave up everything to come to Israel and become a Jew. And she made this pledge to Naomi, which is quite a powerful pledge. She said, "Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God." For us, we don't have to become Jews to be able to worship the one true God. And that's the revelation that Paul was talking about, that we are heirs in common. We're not replacement heirs. We are heirs in common with the Jews. Gentiles now remain Gentiles and gain the benefits of becoming fellow heirs and recipients of the promises that were made available through Jesus by the gospel. from the secret that's been revealed, we get an insight that the kingdom parables reveal information about this church age. Now, we have a look at the layout of Matthew chapter 13. We find that there's seven parables listed, and there's a couple of passages where Jesus talks about why he spoke in parables, which we've already covered. And then three of these seven parables Jesus explains, but the other four he doesn't. So I want to look at them as a set. You know, Jesus presented all of these at once about the same topic of the kingdom. They all start with the kingdom is like, you know, so they all have a common theme. There are actually five other kingdom parables listed in future chapters in Matthew. So these are the other five parables which we're not going to cover. But so there's a total of 12 parables about the kingdom, and they all have the same thing of, you know, the kingdom is like. So we'll cover those other five parables at some future date as we work through, you know, the life of Jesus. Now, the thing with 12 seems to be associated with the kingdom somehow. There's not just 12 kingdom parables, there's also 12 kingdom mysteries that are mentioned. There's 12 apostles who rule over the 12 tribes. There's 12,000 sealed from each of the 12 tribes. The New Jerusalem has 12 gates, 12 foundations. It's 12,000 by 12,000 by 12,000 furlongs. So 12 seems to be a number associated with the kingdom, for those that are into understanding the number significance. So today we're just looking at the seven kingdom parables in Matthew 13. And we've seen that Jesus is explaining them using a kind of a coded system. When a diplomat wants to send a message back to their home country, they'll write it in code so that someone who intercepts that message doesn't understand it, right? We're quite familiar with encoded message, and then you have to use a key to decode it. Well, Jesus is effectively doing the same thing with these kingdom parables. He's hiding information from those he doesn't want to reveal it to, and by revealing the code, he's making it known to those he does want it known to. So when you decode a message, you take the key and you apply it consistently through the whole message, right? So this is an example of a coded message, for example. So you've got these symbols across the top, and then each would be translated to what it means, and you then have the message revealed. So we could take a message like that and take a guess at what it means, you know, if we didn't have the key, and say, oh, that looks a bit like a T, that looks a bit like an E, and you know, and it just is gibberish. It makes no sense without the key. Okay, let's say we just focus on the last two parts of the code, the next slide. Say we're given pieces of the code, right? Well, now we might sort of take a guess, well, maybe this really means too loud. That would fit, and it would give a meaningful message, right? So, but if we have the whole key, this is actually the Greek alphabet translated to English, and then we apply the proper key to the coded message, you see that the code actually says Jesus is Lord. So is loud fitted and it made sense, but was it what the code was really about? No. So let's use the same process with these parables. Jesus has given us an explanation of some of them, and if we apply that explanation that he uses consistently through the rest of them, let's see what we get. So I believe the Bible has actually given us all the information we need to make sense of these parables. The first one's very familiar to us, the four soils. I'd be surprised if you haven't heard at least half a dozen sermons on the four soils. It's such a great topic to talk about. And Jesus has, of course, told us what it means, so there's no great surprise. We'll just read it through and the explanation, and we'll pick up what keys he's given for us to understand the other parables. Then he began to tell them many things in parables. He said, "Listen, a farmer went out to sow, and as he was sowing, some seeds fell along the path, and birds came and ate them up. Other seeds fell on stony ground where they did not have a lot of soil. They sprouted at once because the soil wasn't deep, but when the sun came out, they were scorched. Since they didn't have any roots, they dried up. Other seeds fell among thorn bushes, and the thorn bushes grew higher and choked them out. But other seeds fell on good soil and produced a crop, some 100, some 60, and some 30 times what was sown. Let the person who has ears listen." Now that phrase at the end is actually used seven times throughout the New Testament in the Gospels, and it's also used in the seven letters that Jesus wrote to the seven churches. So there's a linkage there. So then Jesus explained in private with the disciples, he explained what the meaning was. He said, "Listen then to the parable about the farmer. When anyone who hears words about the kingdom yet doesn't understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is what was sown along the path. As for what was sown on stony ground, this is a person who hears the word and accepts it joyfully at once, but since he doesn't have any root in himself, he lasts only for a short time. And when trouble or persecution comes along because of the word, he immediately falls away. As for what was sown amongst the thorn bushes, this is the person who hears the word, but the worries of life and the deceitful pleasures of wealth choke the word so that it cannot produce a crop. But as for this, what was sown on good soil, this is the person who hears the word and understands it and produces a crop that yields 100, 60 or 30 times what was sown. So the seed that's sown is the word, one part of the key that Jesus has given. The word is the good news message that Jesus is communicating to the world. So who do the birds represent? Well, in verse 19, Jesus says that's the evil ones that snatch away the seed. So the birds are bad in parables. You remember the when Joseph was in the Old Testament, you know, Joseph in Genesis, he was in prison and he had the Pharaoh's baker and the Pharaoh's wine steward with him, and they both had dreams. And the baker had the dream of the layers of bread on his head, and the birds came and ate the bread on the top, and that was a bad omen for him. It meant that he was going to die, but the wine steward, he was restored to his job. Birds, when you're given a specific species of bird, like a dove or an eagle, that doesn't seem to be a negative connotation in the biblical usage. But when you just get this generic term birds, it seems to be consistently a bad thing. So the next parable is the tares and the wheat. And again, this is one that Jesus has explained. So we'll try and pick up some keys out of this one to apply to the others. He presented another parable to them, saying, "The kingdom from heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. While people were sleeping, the enemy came and sowed weeds amongst the wheat and went away. When the crop came and up and bore again, the weeds appeared too. The owner's servants came and asked him, 'Master, you sowed good seed in the field, didn't you? Where did all these weeds come from?' And he told them, 'An enemy did this.' The servants asked him, 'Do you want us to go and pull them out?' He said, 'No. If you pull out the weeds, you might pull out the wheat with them. Let them grow together until the harvest. And at the harvest time, I will tell the reapers, gather the weeds first, tie them in bundles for burning, but bring the wheat into my barn.'" So the wheat, or tares as they're called in the King James, are probably a plant called zizania. And it's a plant that's found in the Middle East even today. And it looks a lot like wheat as it's growing. But when it gets to full maturity, it turns a black colour. So it shows its true colours, if you like. And so it's easier to spot the difference when it's at full maturity. And if you get that seed mixed in with your wheat and you make bread out of it, it becomes poisonous. So it's quite important to get it out of the wheat. So Jesus explained this parable, and he says, "When Jesus left the crowds and went into the house, his disciples came to him and asked, 'Explain to us the parable about the weeds in the field.' And he answered, 'The person who sows the good seed is the Son of Man, while the field is the world.'" So you've got this, again, he's saying the field is the world. So he's reinforced it's the same idiom used again. "The good seed are those that belong to the kingdom, while the weeds are those that belong to the evil one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Just as the weeds are gathered and burned with fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will gather from his kingdom everything that causes others to sin, and those who practice lawlessness. They will be thrown into a blazing furnace. In that place there will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in their Father's kingdom. Let the person who has ears listen." So you've got that same phrase again, let the person who has ears listen. So from these first two parables, we can pick up a number of keys to understanding the other ones. The sower is Jesus. The field is the people of the world, birds are Satan's workers, and the reapers are angels. There's also a consistent theme so far of this battle between good and evil. From these insights, we can see how Jesus' code system works, and we can apply it to the next parable. which is the mustard seed. He presented another parable to them, saying, "The kingdom from heaven is like a mustard seed that a man took and planted in his field. Although it is the smallest of seeds, when it is fully grown, it is larger than the garden plants and becomes a tree, and the birds of the sky come and nest in its branches." Now, some people would read this parable from a Gentile perspective and take it out of the context of the set of seven parables, and probably say something like, "Well, it's like seed of faith in your heart that grows." And you know, that's a bit like the too loud kind of translation of the code we had before. It kind of fits, it makes sense, but is it what's really intended? Or it might be that Christianities are going to expand through the whole world, or you could use that parable to mean a number of different things. But what we're really after is, well, what did Jesus really intend from this? Now, mustard seeds grow into quite small, sort of flimsy plants. They're not very woody. When I was in the States as an exchange student, I lived amongst orchards where they used mustard underneath the orchard trees and used it as a green crop. So they let it grow up to flowers like that, and then they just mowed it in, and it became like a fertilizer for the trees. And so I was reasonably familiar with what mustard's like. So the plant doesn't grow big enough to support the weight of a bird. It's not strong enough, and also it's not tall enough that the bird would feel safe from predators. So birds don't roost in mustard. What Jesus is using here is he's talking about a mustard plant that has grown bigger than what it was created to be. It's a monstrosity. That's the word I found here. So it's grown much bigger than it was created to be, and it's become so large that birds can rest in its branches. Now, if we apply the key that Jesus given us earlier, that birds in these parables represent the workers of Satan, then this is a plant that's grown bigger than intended, and it's enabled the workers of Satan to come and be part of it or rest in it. Right from the beginning, the church has had workers of Satan in amongst the church. I mean, you had Judas amongst the 12 disciples. You had Ananias and Sapphira in the Jerusalem church. You have Simon Magus in the church in Samaria. And in Paul's letters, there's quite a few examples where he's writing against people that were within the church teaching stuff that was not right. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, we read, "For such people are false prophets, deceitful workers, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It is not surprising then if his servants also masquerade as servants of righteousness. The end will be what their actions deserve." The next parable uses different idioms from the other ones, and so we're going to have to look outside of what Jesus said in these seven parables to understand this one. But there are answers in the rest of the Bible. This is the woman and the leaven. And he told them another parable. "The kingdom of heaven is like leaven." Leaven's like baking soda or something, you know, you mix in with bread to make bread rise. "The kingdom of heaven is like leaven that a woman hid in three measures of flour till it was all leavened." Now that's all Jesus says, right? So like the mustard seed parable, this one has had a lot of sermons preached about it based on a fairly superficial study of it. This is one verse that in the NIV and the New Living Translation, they just say the woman mixed it in. And I think that kind of hides the real intent of the word that's translated there. It really is hid. It's a devious thing that she's doing. It's not what supposed to be doing. The three measures of flour is immediately recognized by Muslims and Jews as being the fellowship offering and commemorating the event in Genesis 18 where Abraham had the three visitors come and he says to his wife Sarah, you know, quickly prepare a meal for these three visitors. And so she took three measures of meal, which is where, if you do your search of your Bible, that's where that first comes up. And, of course, there wasn't time to allow leaven to allow the bread to rise, so she made unleavened bread. And that's where three measures of meal is associated with that event, with not putting leaven in the bread. And it's also mentioned in Leviticus as one of the many offerings that they had to do. So to us Gentiles, three measures of meal just seems like a bit of extra detail that, you know, the fact that there was three of them, we sort of don't really recognize what it's alluding to. It's this event in Genesis. And so the idea of putting leaven in three measures of meal is just abhorrent. To someone with a Jewish perspective, they recognize that what this woman's doing is really evil. And leaven is consistently used through both the Old and the New Testament to represent something bad. It's considered a symbol of sin by both Jewish and Christian scholars, because the way it works is by puffing up. And the very original sin was when Satan fell because of pride. He got puffed up with pride. And that's why they associate leaven with the sin of pride, the original sin. You know, Satan's fall is found in Isaiah 14. Also in the Passover ceremony, one of the things that the family will do is they will hide a little bit of leaven somewhere in the house, and the children have the job of searching the whole house to find that bit of leaven and getting rid of it. It's just part of the ceremony that they do. I'll put the notes on the website. I was going to go through some of the passages in the New Testament that, you know, talking about like the leaven of the Pharisees and things being their false doctrines, and another place in Luke, the leaven of the Pharisees is described as their hypocrisy. And I'll give you the references out of the Old and the New Testament on the notes as well. Let's have a look at the treasure in the field. The kingdom from heaven is like treasure hidden in a field that a man found and hid. In his excitement, he went and sold everything he had and bought that field. Now, this parable is not saying that we should sell everything we have and buy Jesus. I mean, that really doesn't make sense. I don't know why people sometimes think that. What Jesus offers us is by grace. And grace, by definition, you can't buy or earn. It is a free gift. What we receive is an undeserved free gift, and when we put our trust in what Jesus has done for us. And so to think that we can add anything to that through our own efforts is really just arrogance. To think that we can add to what God has called complete simply doesn't make sense. The treasure is hidden in the field, and Jesus said that the field in his parables represents the world. Now, it's not treasure in the whole field, it's only in a part of the field. So it's interesting to note also that in Exodus 19 and Psalm 135, God's people are described as his special treasure. Now, Exodus 19 verse 5 says, "Now therefore, if you indeed obey my voice and keep my commandments, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine." And Psalm 135 verse 4 says, "For the Lord has chosen Jacob for himself, Israel for his special treasure." So the Lord does use this term special treasure to mean his chosen people. The one that gave up everything he had for the sake of the treasure is Jesus. He wanted the treasure. He didn't buy just that one part of the field. He bought the whole field. He paid the price for the entire earth, for all people, but not all people are the treasure. Only those who accept his free gift are the treasure. See how that makes more sense than us selling everything to buy Jesus? And if you're not sure that you're part of the treasure, then the most important thing you've got to do today is to really speak to someone about that. The next parable is kind of similar, but different in an important way. Pearl of great price. Again, the kingdom from heaven is like a merchant searching for fine pearls. When he finds a very valuable pearl, he went and sold everything he had and bought it. Now, this is a really unusual parable for a Jewish rabbi to be speaking to Jewish people, because, I mean, they didn't value pearls. Pearls weren't kosher. They came out of oysters, which they weren't allowed to eat. They could only eat seafood that had scales on it. So they didn't wear pearls as a gem. They were a Gentile thing. We know that not all Gentiles will be saved, and so the pearl can't be representing all Gentiles. Jesus didn't sell everything he had and buy all Gentiles. But there is one predominantly Gentile entity, and that is the church. The church is largely pretty much Gentile, and the church is a single entity, like that single pearl. And I think that could be what this parable is about, that Jesus sold everything he had to get this entity, the church, to pay the price for us. Pearls are the only jewel that is made by a living organism. And it's a response to an irritation, you know, like a little bit of sand gets in the oyster, and it puts this coating on it and keeps building up this coating, and that's how you get a pearl. But then a pearl is removed from the place where it's created to become an ornament. And I think that's, if I'm right about this interpretation, I think that's kind of a neat idiom for the church, being we're here on earth and we're removed and become an ornament, an adornment. You know, the bride of Christ putting on the white robes and being presented to her bridegroom in heaven in the marriage supper of the Lamb. I think maybe that's what this pearl being removed and being an item of adornment and being a Gentile, largely Gentile thing. That's how I would interpret it anyway. The last parable, thankfully, has been decoded by Jesus, and that's the dragnet. Again, the kingdom of from heaven is like a large net thrown into the sea and gathered all kinds of fish. When it was full, the fishermen hauled it ashore, and they sat down and sorted the good fish into containers and threw the bad ones away. And then Jesus' explanation for this, which he gave, as usual, privately to the disciples. This is how it will be at the end of the age. The angels will go out, cull out the evil people from among the righteous ones, and will throw them into a blazing furnace. And at that place there will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. So this is a lot like the tares parable, tares and the wheat. Again, it had angels doing the gathering. So there's consistency again in how these things are applied. It's one other thing I wanted to show you, and that this is a lot probably less accepted by scholars than what I've shown you so far. So, you know, see what you think. The seven kingdom parables have this connection with this seven letters to the seven churches. You've got the same thing of, you know, he that has an ear, let him hear, kind of phrase. And they're both from Jesus. You know, the seven letters and seven churches are dictated by Jesus through John. And I think it's interesting that some scholars have noted that the order that they're given in matches the profile of the history of the church. And let's take a couple of examples of the ones that are a little more, you know, that I've talked about, a little more controversial. So the mustard seed and the woman and the leaven. In the order that Jesus gave these, the mustard seed aligns with the letter to Pergamos. Now, the name Pergamos means it's a perverted marriage. And this would match up with the time in church history where the church became married to the world. It became the state religion of Rome. And so because it was then a politically correct entity for people to be part of, anyone who wanted to have influence and power in society suddenly joined the church and got into these influential positions, and it had nothing to do with their interest in God or having a relationship with God. It was the church then became huge, much bigger than Jesus intended, and it allowed these evil people to come in. So it's like the birds coming into this overgrown mustard bush. So I think there's a good match there. The woman and the leaven, well, that would match up with the story of Thyatira. And the thing about the church at Thyatira is you had this woman who was a false prophet. So again, you've got a woman doing evil things, teaching evil ways to the church at Thyatira, bringing in false doctrine and stuff. So I think there's a good match there as well. And likewise with the other ones, the dragnet and Laodicea, you know, the end, the very last ones, talking about the separation and so on. So anyway, it's a whole study in itself to look at the comparisons of those two. The reason I take it fairly seriously is because I think the chances of these two sets of seven matching the profile of church history for the last 2,000 years are very slim. If you've got seven things in a list like that, there's over 5,000 different possible combinations of how you can list those seven, because you've got 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 3 times 2. Gives you about 5,020, I think, if I did my maths right. So that's just the chances of the list being in the right order to match the church history for one of the sets of seven. When you've got two lists like that, you've got 5,000 times 5,000, which is 25 million. So what that's saying is that the chances of these two lists both matching the profile of the church history exactly in the right order is like one chance in 25 million. That's why I take it seriously, because I think Jesus, as the author of both of these, has actually purposely chosen that order. He could have chosen any order he liked. And why did he choose those churches? Why didn't he do a church letter to the church in Rome or the church in Jerusalem? They were much more important churches than these ones that he chose, that some of them we'd never heard of other than these letters, you know? So for what it's worth, I think there's something in it. What can we take away from this whole study of these seven kingdom parables? Well, to me, if this interpretation is correct, that Jesus is predicting the history of the church, then that gives me confidence that Jesus knew ahead of time what the church was going to be facing, the ups and downs of history, the persecution, and it becoming the state religion, and then all of what's happened through history, the split with the Protestants and so on, are all mapped out by this, by these parables and by these seven letters. And so that means that Jesus, being God, and God is the only one who can see ahead of time what's going to happen. We know angels can't see the future because the angels are watching for how God's plan unfolds. And that applies to Satan. He's a fallen angel, so he can't see the future either. Otherwise, he wouldn't have allowed God to trick him into crucifying Jesus and being part of the plan. He would have not been duped, you know. So Satan is no more able to see the future than any other angel. But Jesus has been able to map out the future of the church from that point in time. And I think that gives me amazing comfort that he knows what we're going to face individually and as a church, and he can prepare us because he knows what's ahead. So, you know, I see the Bible as this amazing book that has the Holy Spirit's fingerprints all through it. Although it's written by, you know, 40 different authors, there is these themes that go through and connect things together. And I love seeing these connections between different parts, like this connection that I see between the parables and the letters to the seven churches. So I would hope that, you know, I've inspired you to think about it and maybe do a bit more research on, say, Levin or something and see what you think. And that, I think, would be a good outcome. Thank you.